Hello.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is Igal Fedida. He's a modern painter who was trained as a photographer. And once he found that the two-dimensionality of photography was not enough to express his emotions, to express his vision, he turned to art, abstract art. But it's not just art. It isn't just a series of lines or a series of dots or throwing paint at the canvas as some so-called artists have done. It is abstract art with a meaning, based on Yahadut, on Yiddishkeit, on Judaism. He's currently opened a gallery in Manhattan on First Avenue, on 1482 First Avenue between 77th and 78th. And all the works he exhibits there follow the theme of Bereshit, in the beginning, the theme of creation. His works have to be seen. Only then can you understand the depth of feeling. Only then can you understand what it meant to create a universe. I have the pleasure, the honor of speaking to Igal, and I hope you will call in with questions and comments at 714-333-3357. Good evening, Igal.
Shalom, Chaim, shalom. It's a pleasure to have you, to be on your show.
The pleasure is mine, and the pleasure will also be of those who care to listen to us. So, I have seen your work. I have spoken to you at length on quite a few opportunities during the past week since I met you. Mm-hmm. I would like the audience to hear about your life's journey. First, you do not come from a traditional religious home, and yet your art is the art of somebody who's highly spiritual, highly religious. What brought you to that journey? What makes Igal Fedida tick? What is it that gives him the energy, the vision to paint the way you do?
Wow, that's a big question. I always like to say that I have those certain years of living as a human being on this earth, but I think I lived many lives, and I'm containing or carrying with me different journeys, and it's all come together to be where I am today. And but I think the journey, in a way, of what you expressed as spiritual and creating in the field of Judaism and all that, I really think it takes me somewhere into before creating what I'm creating today, and really being in the meaning of coming to the States as an Israeli, and not coming from a very religious, you know, in Israel everybody is a Masorti, what we call it, and especially coming from a Sephardic background, Sephardic family, we all have that motives of connecting a bit to Judaism in us, but yet only in coming to the States and starting life in here in the fullest and living the American, chasing the American dreams, let's call it like this, this is where really I felt that I'm missing a dimension. I'm missing something in me. There is a calling in me that needs to be expressed, need to be shown, need to be discovered. Some call it identity. Some call it, you know. And I felt that this is where I need to be. So I start to search. What is to be a Jew in America? What is to be Israeli Jew in America? What is to be Israeli out of the land of Israel? What is to work on Friday night to see everybody go to synagogue and you go to work and it's all perfectly okay. The life continue and begin, you know. And what is to? And I discovered that I came to the point, like I would say about 15 years ago, that I don't like to say I become tshuva. But I would say I start to find the roots of being who I am. What is my ancestors? What is to be in the shoes of my ancestors? What is to have the identity of to be a Jew? To have that ID card of being a Jewish in the state. And of course, with the tool given to me as an artist, I start to pursue those elements in my work to say, okay, I'm a modern. Obviously, I'm living in almost 2013. I'm living and understanding the life of today. Everybody with iPhone, everybody with iPad. Everything is so modern. Everything is fast. Everything is. What is to be a Jewish artist within all these things? How you going to express all those things? And I brought this modern motif into who I am, which something like maybe 2,000-4,000 years, and it all goes together beautifully, perfectly.
Now,
I think,
tell us a little bit about your early background. From a religious point of view, it did not seem much promise. In fact, let's start by hearing from you about your early background, and then I'm going to have some more questions to ask you.
Early background, very, very funny background. I mean, in a way, I grew up in what we call it today, the Ma'abarot. I still age of 7. I grew up in the Ma'abara of city of Lod. You know, where you land in Israel, they're telling you welcome to Tel Aviv, but you're actually welcome to Lod, into the airport. And this is where I grew up. Until of age of 7, we lived, three brothers, in, I don't know what it was, like a precast, you know, asbestos, 20 meter on 20 meter. And this is how I, you know, to the Moroccan family, and we grew up there, and then we went to the Shikunim, and then we went to the typical immigrant family that came to Israel in the 1960s. And the funny thing is that, you know, a little story, a little anecdote that is a little bit. At age of 3, my the teacher in my kindergarten called it my mom, and I say, "What's going on with this kid? I mean, why is he sitting on the side and you telling him not to get dirty and not to play with everybody? And I mean, why he's so clean? He doesn't want to paint. He doesn't want to play in the ground, the sand. And what's going on?" And my mom, of course, said, "You know, of course I didn't tell him not to do those. So this, I mean, I never tell him something like that." So I came as a child as an observer, you know, sitting on the side and seeing everybody painting and seeing everybody creating, and I was just looking. And in one point, everything came out, and I started to create, and through all my elementary school and through my high school, which I've been in various places, and even in the army, when every time when needed to be creating something, I was the one that needed to do that. I will do the cartoons, I will do the signs, everything. And so it was something that always was carrying with me. And that's it. Finished the army, I was a parachuter. I was Tanhan. came to the state. Came to the state, as I said, to earn some little bit money, and then to go to travel in South America, the usual trip of all the Israelis that finished the army. I went to South America with my girlfriend, which today she is my wife, and we did 7 months backpacking. And after that, I called from Rio de Janeiro to my brother, and I said, hey, I ran out of money, buy me a ticket. So he bought me the ticket back to Los Angeles, which I had to work a few months later and to pay back for that ticket. And my life started in the big Los Angeles. And I started to work for a production company, and I did for them all the design, the design, and they used to have the VHS covers for the videos. So I will do photography for that, and I will do calligraphy for that, and I will do this, and I'll do that. And few years later, I found myself, because I needed to create some money to home, and that was not enough. So I found myself in the building and the design field, like my brothers, that they are contractors, and I started to do that. Parallel to that, I continued to draw and to paint with oil, and then I took a course in UCLA, and I did photography. So for a long 10 years, I did photography. I had the darkroom at home, and I would work and create and work and create. And then life began when I completely became an artist, you know.
So how exactly did you gravitate away from photography and into painting?
I tell you what, it's combined few things. It's combined few things. I think in one point, photography was not fulfilling anymore, and I couldn't express myself. The tool of the camera was not enough. It was not giving me enough to express my inner, my voice, my really who I am and what I want to say. I thought that there is some much deeper meaning to what I want to say, and I left it. I left it for a while and concentrate on creating, building my family and my company and my assets and everything else. But I became sick. I became literally very ill physically, and felt that something needed to be happening in my life. It really became, it paralyzed me, the fact that I'm not creating and something needs to be done with it. And it was, now I'm talking about it like very logic, like, okay, that was my solution. I need to heal myself through this and I need to create that. I didn't know at the moment. I was very confused, but I knew that my life is not in the fullest and I need to do something with it. And I'm still, again, and I'm not happy. I'm making okay money, good money. The family is well, this and that. But something is missing, and shortly after I start dramatically, like painting everywhere I am. I opened the studio in my office area and at my job. I opened an office a studio in my home. I will travel with my brushes. I will, everywhere I go, I paint. I will paint after 10, 12, 14 hours of working every day. I will go and paint. And Saturday night, right after Shabbat, I will paint till Sunday morning, till I'm collapsing myself. And I was, till today, very prolific, very, very prolific, painting a lot. And I start a process of understanding that I cannot anymore paint / create the outside wall, the outside to the inside, which can be the negative of the film or the canvas or any surface, but more painting and creating from the inside out, more expressing what I feel, what I really want to say, my voice to the outside. And that's what happened. And it was amazing because the process of it was very intense, very, very intense. I will paint and cry, and emotionally was very involved into so much, but I will study a lot within too, and I would combine so much of meditation and yoga and healthy food and cleansing and everything. I was like body and soul, everything together into that process of learning, of understanding of who I am. And thank God that brought me to where I am today, you know.
And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, ladies and gentlemen, please give us a call at 714-333-3357. That's 714-333-3357. Igal, I'm going to read a short paragraph from Jackson Pollock's Mind Painting. He describes what a painting means to him. I'm going to ask you if you have the same feelings, and if not, how do you differ?
Okay.
And I quote, "My painting does not come from the easel. I prefer to tag the unstretched canvas to the hard wall or to the floor. I need the resistance of hard surface. On the floor, I am more at ease. I feel nearer, more part of the painting, since this way I can walk around it, work from the four sides, and literally be in the painting. I continue to get further away from the usual painter's tools such as easels, palettes, brushes, etc. I prefer sticks, trowels, knives, and dripping fluid paint on a heavy impasto with sand, broken glass, or other foreign matter added. When I am in my painting, I'm not aware of what I'm doing. It is only after a sort of get acquainted period that I see what I have been about. I have no fear of making changes, destroying the image, etc., because the painting has a life of its own. I try to let it come through. It is only when I lose contact with the painting that the result is a mess. Otherwise, there is pure harmony, an easy give and take, and the painting comes out well." How do you relate to your paintings? Is it similar to Pollock? Is it completely different?
I tell you what, this paragraph you read, we can talk about it about 5-6 radio talks. Okay, you said a lot in that paragraph. But let's try to cover a little bit, maybe few items in it, because there's really a lot. Okay, for one thing, he's mentioning some elements that most of his friends from what we call it the New York School, the 1950s, they're all mentioning the same elements in a different ways, different words. So, for example, for what you said, that he preferred to be in, when he is, the canvas was on the floor, which the canvas of his was unstretched, so he can control and continue the painting from 10 feet to 12 feet to 13 feet, whatever, he can continue and deal with that. He wanted to be in it. He was supposed to be involved. The same thing Mark Rothko saying by painting his big, large canvases of usually prefers to be between 5 to 6 feet when you're stretching your hand on your side. So Mark Rothko said the same thing. When he wants to be in front of the canvas, he wants to paint himself in it. So the canvas needs to be in the size of him, so he doesn't need to imitate nature. He doesn't want to imitate himself. He wants to be in it fully. So when he's painting, when he creates, it's not it's not Mark Rothko paints that piece of canvas outside, but Mark Rothko is in the canvas. And the same thing Pollock saying, and without any attention to that, just for you to know, I'm painting today also on the floor. Now, I paint, I took myself from the easel, which de Kooning said that also. He said one day people won't create anymore with easels. Easels will be something that belongs to history. In my studio, I don't paint anymore in easels. When I teach students on easels, but I myself, I don't need the easel anymore. I need it on the floor, so I put it not necessarily on the floor for the hard surface because I paint usually already stretched or on plywood or on metal, so the surface is anyway already hard, and I don't need that fight between me and the canvas. It's right there. It's plain to me. So I put it on what we call it, like, you know, horse-like tables, and I paint on top. To be around it, to be involved, to be in it, it's big. It's big because you want to be one with what you create. You don't create something that is an extension to you. Just like the brush, the brush is not something that you're holding, but it's becoming one stretched hand. Your brush is part of your hand. Same thing. When he expressed the sticks, yes, he wanted to express that you can paint with whatever is out there for you in order to achieve the fact that you need to express yourself. And the same thing goes for the element of the material. I paint with everything. I paint with building materials. I paint with roofing tar, liquid or solid. I paint with resin. I paint with polyurethane. I paint with enamel, flat-based, water-based, oil-based. I paint with everything that the character of the material can help me to express what I want to express. So this is where he took it. And the beauty about the whole paragraph of what you said about Pollock, and I think, you know, we talked about it earlier, we talked about it before, me and you. One may not like the painting of Pollock. One may say that Pollock was, it's not his taste, and not to give it the fully aesthetic beauty, like let's say when we compare it to Rothko or to someone else. Mm-hmm. But it was not about, and this is where I'm giving a lot of credit to Pollock, because this is not, it is not about the piece that you see or I see as the viewer, but the process of it. And he's the one that first, or one of those first, to bring really the freedom of, he understood that he need to express himself, and the process, him involved in the piece, is much more important than the result, which is the piece that you see in the end of the day. And that was big.
Okay, now let me read another short paragraph from Vasily Kandinsky. Let me give a little bit of background for the audience. Vasily Kandinsky was Russian, born in Moscow. He gave up a promising career teaching law and economics to go to school, art school in Meissen, in Germany. What got him interested in going to school was a impressionistic painting by Monet, Haystacks.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the following, and I quote, that it was a haystack, the catalog informed me. I could not recognize it. This non-recognition was painful to me. I recognized that the painter had no right to paint indistinctly. I duly felt that the object of the painting was missing, and I noticed with surprising condition and confusion that the picture not only gripped me, but impressed me ineradicably, it impressed itself in my memory. Painting took on a fairy tale power and splendor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in his early paintings, when he started in 1908, it's easy to recognize the influence of Monet. Later on, however, Kandinsky became very, very geometrical and completely turned away from that. What exactly was he trying to express by doing that? And how does that compare with your method of expression? And I realize fully that although Kandinsky may have been somewhere in the back of your mind, he is absolutely not somebody I could say influenced you greatly. But still, I would like to hear your opinion on what I just read. And I'm sure it's not a fair question, but I never said I was going to be fair.
Okay, first of all, I mean, I'm not sure about the last sentence, but I want to say something before if you, and then you will realize that. But I want to say something. First of all, Kandinsky, what you're telling me about his influence from the piece of the haystack of Matisse, it's known.
By Monet.
There's another Monet is one event that recorded, but there was another event around the same time. He was in an he was visiting a show, an orchestra by I think it was Wagner. I'm not sure. And he said in that when he stepped out, he said, I am not going to deal with my career as an attorney anymore. I am going to paint the music that I hear. And that was one of the influences of him, again, just like he saw the piece of by Monet as elements of, when you're telling me, and when I read that first in my life, I thought I saw what he felt, which, because if you're looking at the haystack, the idea that you don't recognize the haystack and you can just look at them as bundles of paint, bundles of tones, different tones of earth tones that come into play to you, and then you just need to, in a way, what attracting your eye first is your right brain dealing with what you see, that abstract thing that been dealt with by Monet. But then, which is something that's happening a lot, the left brain taking over, and he starts to translate it. Oh, okay, I see haystacks. The same thing was happening in that concert that he went to. He was listening to that music, but he saw it in colors, and that was in a very abstract, element. Just like we sang in the Ma'amad of Har Sinai, we sang that they saw the voices. He saw the voices, and that's something very spiritual, very very high, that maybe was in a level of a prophecy for someone like that, because good enough, sure enough, it changed his life, and that's amazing. So I can relate to that fully, but I really think that, you know, he made history, and we calling today and we're saying that, sure enough, we're saying that he is the father of the abstraction movement. But I think it happens to few at the same time, and I think that's what it was, a development of the society and the people. You know, people are changing, and when people are changing, the art of his generation is adapting in the follow. We're not staying the same. So you know, he did what Kazimir Malevich discovered before him in Russia. Kazimir Malevich did this what you call it, the forms we shape with the, you know, the mathematism and put the squares together. And so there was a few, I will call it Nevi'im. Yes, there were a few of each one. This one coming from Russia. This one is influenced from Germany. This one is influenced. And start to move those things together. But Kandinsky obviously was succeeding to make that the history. But in the end of the day, we remember Kandinsky only because of the freedom that he has to those gestures on his canvases. Not for early years as a painter, not at all.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not for the Arabic figures that he painted in the influence of in Russia and being in St. Petersburg and all that. And nothing for the forms that he painted, but only for the really the freedom of those canvases that very much remind us the later movement that was the surrealism.
Right. Now, what you said about him being influenced by music, it is obvious from his book that music was very, very important to him because he says, for example, that color on the painter's palette evoke a double effect, a purely physical effect on the eye, which is charmed by the beauty of colors, similar to the joyful impression when we eat a delicacy. But the effect is much, much deeper, however, causing a vibration of the soul or an inner resonance, a spiritual effect in which the color touches the soul itself. In other words, color, according to this phrase, has just become sound, has just become the music that touches the soul, except that in Kandinsky's case, instead of using an instrument, a musical instrument, he uses color to evoke emotions.
Yes. Yes. Music is, of course, as you know, is one of the highest, if not the highest form of translating a spiritual
right.
feeling.
In fact, in Hasidut, music is regarded as the prayer of the soul. The soul
yes.
does not pray in words, does not speak in words like you and me, because words, no matter how deep, are very limited. It is impossible to express with words everything that the soul, everything that the heart feels.
Absolutely.
However,
and that,
music
yes.
transcends all those boundaries.
Correct. And furthermore, I will add what Rabbi Nachman from Breslev said, that and if every person have his own nigun, where
that's correct.
I am
his own inner nigun.
Exactly. And where I'm taking it is that there is a room for music to open the heart and talks to a person where every other form fail. A person cannot listen to someone else to teach him something. A person cannot listen to his beloved wife. A person cannot listen to the actions that's happening in his life. As a person and so forth. Many things. But there is a nigun. There is a note, a higher note. This is where David HaMelech writing the Tehillim. There is a special form of music that can reach every neshama. And that
absolutely
is, and that can be translated in painting to color. And this is the beauty about canceling the form, canceling object, canceling anything that can boundary the element of free gestures and let the person that wants to express himself on the canvas, wood, panel, it doesn't matter what it is, through color. And that was Kandinsky, where he saw that music coming to play in his into his painting. When I teach my students in my studio, I'm teaching them first exercise is to close the eyes, having a paper in front of them, putting few squares in front of them, squares that we're creating, you know, like 5 inches by 5 inches squares, many of them, and I put mm-hmm. music. Usually it can be classic music, or it can be a good free jazz music, or usually and better without words. So again, I want to quiet the mind, and I want just to have the music free yourself from inside. And I let them just have the hand moving in the gestures of the music. That opened up completely. That's step one to bring yourself out and let the music translate your emotion into what you need to put down on your paper, on your canvas. So definitely music became also in my life a very, very, very important tool, which everywhere I go, I mean, you've been in my studio in the...
Yeah, I've been in your studio and there's constantly music going on, yes.
Constantly music that is coming from all over the world. I'm listening to Sufi music, I'm listening to classic Arabic, I'm listening to Greek, I'm listening to Italian, jazz, classic, whatever. Everything needs to be on because it's expressing every different mood of where I am.
Now, if I were to ask you, you mentioned the New York School of Painters as something that obviously affected you. If I were to ask you, who are the painters who exerted the greatest influence on your style, even though your style is unique and quite different, but who were the names that you base yourself on when you first started painting, before you fully developed your own style?
Wow. Well, obviously we have the big names of Willem de Kooning and Lee Krasner and Helen Frankenthaler and Barnett Newman and Pollack and Ad Reinhardt, Clifford Steele, you know, those, yeah, the big names. But I want to say that, you know, since, you know, I'm a self-taught, and when I start to get crazy like that with myself that I need to paint a lot, and I didn't have no one to share what's coming out. Is it valid? Is it okay what I'm painting? Am I just a crazy man that doing this? I mean, am I going back to my childhood and I'm becoming like, what's going on? I didn't have who to ask. I was not in an environment, in an artistic environment, that I would have this panel like I'm talking with you right now. I was in myself. So I would paint the painting, and I would run to Barnes and Noble to see if there is someone that paints something like that. And I would do that many times. And interesting enough is that the first book I purchased was actually for Jasper Jones. That is not really the first generation of the New York School. It's the second generation, maybe even third. I mean, and it was not even considered really to where I am today, which I took completely the expressions out, which he was, you know, the famous flag or the famous target or, you know. And so I bought this book, and then I will go back, and then I found myself buying a book from Richter, the German painter, and I love what he did, and I say, oh my God, well, I'm doing the same, you know, and slowly I came to the New York School. When I found myself in the New York School, I like what I saw from Pollack, I like what I saw from Rothko, I like what I saw from Barnett Newman. But that was not enough. I said, wow, this is a genius piece, but this is not enough. There is something deeper than that I need to understand. So I start to really read about them and who they are, what they represent, what they want to express. And this is where really I fall in love with the philosophy of each one of them and with the era, with what happened in that New York. And I'm taking it as a whole one scheme. I cannot separate William de Kooning from Rothko, and I cannot separate Rothko from Pollack. They are all sitting in the same cafe, fighting every night, talking and smoking. And to me, it's all one layer of people that I am relate, including the people that were around them that making that crowd. Leo Castile, the gallery, the famous gallery. The art critic of the time, Rosenberg and Greenberg, and all of them, and I start to read and to read and to find really more depth and connection to where I am, and finally, and finding also, you know, Mark Rothko, I found his pain. I understood his pain. I understood, maybe, I mean, I need to be too humble to say that I understood him fully, but I want to say that I came to understand, you know, Mark Rothko is a Bahur Yeshiva, that his name is Markus Rothkovich, and he came to from Russia, immigrant boy. That's
right.
So I related to that Jewish boy and his pain and what led him in the end to commit suicide, which people say he didn't commit suicide, but all this pain. And Barnett Newman creating the cross, creating all these pieces that people start to find the connection between those pieces and being an artist Jew. What does it mean to be an artist Jew? And they wanted to say, no, there is no such Jewish art. There is no such, and they wanted to separate those things. But since I am an observant and I'm in this world and I take the painting of the whole week into my Shabbat, and then I read Rabbi Nachman, and I read those Kabbalistic literature, and I'm reading the Chumash, and I'm saying, look, these people had this feel, that depth, and I just found myself really drawn into all of them, and this is where I am. But I want to mention one name that is, again, it's not really part of the school. But I don't know if you're familiar with Anthony Tapies. He's a Spanish painter from Barcelona. And
how do you spell his last name?
Tapies. It's if I'm not mistaken, T like Tom, A-P-I-E-S. Tapies.
Tapies. Antonio Tapies.
Antonio Tapies.
Okay.
Yes. His pieces is just marvelous, and he using cement, and he using sand, and he using, it's very expressive. It's, you know, you see huge pieces of just gray sanded pieces, and he have inside the cross, which for him represents life, and I just drawn to him. It's a marvelous art.
Now, as you were developing your current style, as you were searching for something that would allow you to express that which was laying on your soul, I am sure there must have been some very interesting happenings, some things that influenced you one way or another. Care to share some of those with the audience?
Let me understand again the question. Let me. Are you talking about?
Well, in plain English. In plain English. Do you have any interesting anecdotes of your journey?
From my journey. Maybe I will share about the process of the painting. When I start to paint, when I start my process of cleansing, and I told you I was sick and. What I used to do, I used to paint my canvases in black, completely black, and then start to paint. And I did it for a long time, and my pieces were dark. And I realized that, you know, I was afraid. For one thing, I painted right away. It took me a very short time that I both found myself painting big. 4 feet, 5 feet, 6 feet. And the white of the canvas in front of me was so scary that I couldn't get close. I didn't know what to do. It was paralyzing. It was a mirror. It was in front of me like a mirror that I'm looking at myself, and I don't know, well, who am I to paint this? What I need to do with this, you know? So I used to paint them black and then start the painting. And it's marvelous to know later that much later, like much, much later to understand what was the meaning of the black. What is the black? What is the, the in the choshech of the bria, what is to be in the black? What is the full potential of the black? Why it was comforting? Why I was feeling so great with being in the black, and then start to reveal all the layers out? Because you know, in the studio, when you're taking the red, the green, the yellow, the blue, you mix them together, you're getting black. You're getting in the end a form of black. So here I'm starting from the end. I'm taking the black and I'm starting to reveal the color out, which was not easy. And I was dealing with black, dark pieces, because it was not, but it really was where I am with my soul inside. And I needed that. I felt like I'm a clay, I have a vessel of full with not good, unpurified water, and I need to start to wash this with pure water till the vessel will be clean. And that's what happened. And I used to paint it black, start to paint and cry, and being in front of it, and it was taking me great deal. You know, I used to paint and finish with my painting and just collapse and just, or starting another painting and finish two paintings or three paintings at night, working 12, 14 hours in a row, just painting like crazy, and then just collapsing and cannot move. Like all my muscles were, you know, shutting down. And slowly, gradually, I found myself, which you're looking at my pieces today, you see a bright, clean, white pieces. Today I paint the canvas. I get the canvas, I paint it first, 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4 layers of white, and then I start to paint. And it's a beautiful thing that happened to me. I felt like I transformed myself from one point to another point.
Well, I think it also shows a transition in your spiritual level. From a point where you were, I guess, if I could describe it that way, confused, seeking, when there was darkness that you were trying to clear up, and I guess that was the point of putting color on black, you came to the point where you found that light, where through your study of Hasidut, your study of Kabbalistic works, you found some of the answers. And therefore, you found the light, and now you can produce the beautiful color on a white surface instead of a black. And yet, I still detect a lot of black on your paintings, although this time it would seem that it is for a completely different reason.
Yes, you know, in the first sentence we're learning, we're saying, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha'aretz. And we're saying, and there was a tohu vavohu. And we're learning that tohu vavohu, the word bohu, there was everything contained in it. Bohu. All of it was in there.
Right.
And now just the creator needed to put things in order, place shamayim in shamayim, earth in earth. I'm trying to say it in a very simple metaphoric way. And really everything was there. Everything was in me. As before I was born, everything is there. Since I'm 3 years old, I didn't want to touch the sand and didn't want to paint. Everything is there. But it was, like you said, in a bowl. It was in a very big chaos. And I needed to put things in place. And I think I'm still in that journey. And I think we all in that journey till the age of 70, 80, 90 before we giving the keys back. So it's a long journey. It's a long journey, but yes, this is how I see myself. And today, when you see the dark in my pieces, you can identify the spot of the black. It's very clear. Boom, you have a black. And you have the black surrounded with the white. And that's something that also I'm speaking to you, and I realize myself, because we're learning in a Kabbalistic term that, you know, the black fire on top of white fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're saying that the black fire represents the ink, when the white fire represents the parchment, it's a gvil. So now, we cannot, if the black fire that is, we can feel, we can understand. We can feel it, is the ink is taking over of all the space, like what I did with my canvases in the beginning. There is no way to understand anymore what you want to create. And אפשרות של הבנה, ככה כתוב in the Sefer HaYitzchak. There is no room for understanding anymore. But when we really put things in order and we give them the space, the right space it needs, that spot, boom, white. That red spot, boom, white. And everything is in order, there is this beautiful, perfect harmony. And this is what I'm seeking, and I'm wish to have in every of my pieces, of course. Just like in Teva, in the nature.
Looking at your paintings, it is not the traditional Eastern European idea of harmony. And yet, although at first to an Eastern European it may appear like chaos, there is a tremendous harmony. The way the colors flow into each other, the way the colors sometimes complement each other, or the way they contrast each other, the way the colors dance on that canvas, there is a tremendous idea of music that I see in your own paintings.
Yes.
It isn't just, you know, Kandinsky, but there is music in your paintings too.
Yes.
For example, the painting that I can never take my eyes off when I go to your gallery, you know which one it is, the one with the bold colors.
The Let It In.
Right. Let It In. When you look at the blue next to the red, the blue seems to have the dance of water. It is dancing around a color red that is very, very much in contrast to its own blue, and yet it is a perfectly harmonious complementary color to it, in spite of the chaos, in spite of the seeming fight because of the contrast. And all the colors that way,
right,
in every one of your paintings, no matter how contrasty, no matter how different, no matter how different the emotions that they evoke in the viewer, there is a tremendous harmony. There is music in every one of your paintings, at least the way I see it.
Well, I don't know now, and I remember who expressed that before me, but the harmonious that the painting needs to achieve, to convey, is need to be parallel to the harmony of the nature, the Teva.
Right.
And this is the ultimate thing that a painter, an artist, needs to, so let's call it like this, need to control in order to achieve a good, very good painting. And that takes us back to what Pollock said when he said that he's painting on the floor and he goes around it. You know, when you go around a painting and you're painting the painting from four sides, you're creating a full, controlled, balanced painting that then you can view it from four sides. It doesn't matter. It doesn't care anymore where is, because since we don't have figurative, we don't have a head and a leg that you can recognize that the head need to be, and then the legs where they're downward. You actually can view that painting from four sides, and that's a perfect painting. I know a painting I used to know. Now I know because of different things, but I used to know when a painting is done by turning from four sides and to see that everything is balanced. And when everything is balanced, it's creating the perfect painting. And this is where it is, and I think it's the same thing, of course, like in music. It has to be balanced. It has to be harmonious. And you know when it's balanced. We don't have a rule to teach what is really that balance, but you know what is the balance, just like whatever.
Right.
If tomorrow the sun will arise at 12 noon, we will be in trouble. We will know that something is going wrong. And this is exactly what it is. It's a perfect balance, just like in Teva. We are just messengers.
So Let me ask the question that we referred to. Okay, we referred to the subject earlier, but at what point in your life did you decide, did you understand that two-dimensionality does not allow you to express yourself fully? You need far more than the two dimensions. You need far more than the recognizable shape, because a recognizable shape, no matter how recognizable it is not a true representation of the subject. At what point did you decide that you need more? What happened in your life? And you referred to before, I understand, about photography, but obviously there also had to be some inner emotional stage, an emotional fight, and I guess it's the wrong word, but I think you understand what I'm trying to say, an emotional upheaval within you that said, no, Igal, two dimensions are not enough. Recognizability is not good enough.
Well, when you realize, when each one of us understand that we are not just probably body and soul, and there is something higher than us, and something that's higher than that, we trying to fully achieve or understand this, and we want more. And I was in a point in my life that I wanted more. The photography was okay. It bored me, and I put it on the side, and I said, okay, there's nothing for me to take from that. Sitting and painting on an easel, landscape on the beach, or trying to paint a profile of someone, like de Kooning said, we come into a time that to try to paint a nose of someone is absurdity. It's absurd in that. It doesn't achieve anything. It's just to become a good technician that knows how to imitate nature to the inside. And I was not in that place. I was already in a place that I'm seeking much more than that in every aspect in my life. I understood I build a home. I have a good home. I'm making the money. I have a wife. I have four kids. I have everything is in place. Everything is okay. I'm creating what I'm creating. But there is more to that. There is more expression. There is more things that Igal needs to bring out. There is something more to me. There is a gift in me that is not expressed fully. And someone once told me, if you're getting a gift and you're not fully use it, it's like insulting the king. You're insulting Hashem for the gift you got.
Right.
And I said, okay, I have to search. I have to getting deeper into what it is. And the nature of me, I'm not taking things light, and I'm not taking things halfway. And it happened one day that about 8 years ago that I came to my wife and I said, listen, that's it. We're going to take a one-year vacation. It's a year that anywhere you want. And I'm opening a studio, and I'm going to paint the whole year. And after that year, our life is going to change. And that's what happened. And after that year, we sold everything. I changed my life. I changed my occupation. I became a fully artist. Everybody still today think I'm super crazy. But I am in that journey. I'm fully happy. Thank God. I'm 90% healed myself from. I recovered myself from the condition I had before, and I'm fully dedicating myself today to the art with the help of my wife and the kids, and they are my big support. They are my big backbone for all this journey, and good friends that helping and supporting and believing in me, and it's amazing. This is where I am today, and I'm continuing with the search. I'm continue growing every day.
One of the interesting things I find about your paintings, a recurring theme, at least in the series of Bereshit, is your extensive use of the Hebrew alphabet.
Yes.
Especially because creation was done according to the Kabbalistic masters through the 22 letters and their significance and the various unions and permutations and so on. You have one painting on the window of your gallery,
mm-hmm.
a blue painting,
mm-hmm.
cut in half, so to speak, by the Hebrew alphabet.
Yes.
And yes, you can see the sea, you can see the waves, but as you get close to the paintings, you also see the brush strokes, which make the painting that much more relevant, as they now help us understand the three-dimensionality of what it is that you're painting, as those brush strokes stand out. But, at the same time, by seeing the letters right down the center, it is almost like you're hinting at Hashem's will for that water to part or that water to run or that water to be tumultuous and so on. You see the sea in all its power and you see the power of its master through the alphabet. Was that your reason for putting the alphabet there, or was there something else?
Okay, a few things. So, for one thing, one step out and to say that I'm painting for the last 7 years, I'm Bereshit. I'm dealing with Bereshit. We're saying in our prayer, HaMechadesh b'chol yom ha'aseh Bereshit. It's in every day that we're creating. It's in every day that we have an obligation to create and to grow. And it's fascinating that I'm taking the element of creation not from an historic point, not from an historic element, event that was done in one time in history, but something that is really part of us in every day. And that's why it's giving me the strength and the feel to paint, continuous paint, and not getting bored with it. It's unlimited source of giving me something to deal with, to think about. Now, the painting that is in the, is not anymore in the window, by the way, Chaim. But,
oh, you moved it?
I moved it. It's not there anymore. There is the parting of the sea as an element that many times people ask me, how come you're painting the parting of the sea, which is actually an event that's coming from Shemot, from the second book, from Exodus, and it's not mm-hmm. really part of Bereshit because you're painting only Bereshit. I don't paint Judaica. I paint Bereshit. And
mm-hmm.
it's really something that coming to play because we're learning that the opening of the sea was an element. It was an event that was created in the pre-creation time. It's something that was done as
right.
part of the 10 events that was pre-creation. Okay?
Right.
And
it was pre-ordained already.
Right. And we're learning that beautiful midrash, beautiful story, beautiful in the Zohar, I think it's coming that the minister of the sea have a dialogue with HaKadosh Baruch Hu about creating the sea. HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling the sea that in one day my people will be in front of you and you will have to part against the law of nature. If you agree, I create you. If you not agree, I'm not going to create you. So I'm bringing it from that point that it was in Bereshit. Now, the element, the symbolism that I'm using in that painting is that if you notice the lettering of the Shira, of opening of the sea, is written on two parchments.
Mm-hmm.
The two parchments expressing the split. Each of the parchments is 18 inches, which stands for high. Each of the parchments in the background of the scripture is, like you said, having the letters of the 22 letters. The 22
mm-hmm.
letters expressing, the 22 letters expressing, as you say, that we learned that in order to create, God forms the world with the 22 letters. So I'm going to bring the hint why the parting of the sea I painted because of creation and not because of other reason. And we also learned, that in when the people of Israel passing the sea, when they crossing the sea, there were 600 ribbons, and each one of them was as a symbol for one letter in the Torah. So in a way, I'm saying that here, right there, the scripture is not just the script, but it's also the lettering that's expressing right now the images, the people of Israel, each one as a letter. So if you're standing 5, 10, 15 feet away from that, you don't see anymore the letters, but you see really, you see something, bulky ink of figure, and that needs to be example of one of the people that's going and crossing. And that's the beauty of, it's a beautiful piece.
Mm-hmm. And we're just about out of time. It's a pity how fast time flies. And the conversation is interesting when the guest is somebody as fascinating as you.
Thank you.
We're going to have to do this again. In the meantime, I just want to tell the audience that they can come and meet you at your gallery at any time at 1482 First Avenue between 77th and 78th on the Upper East Side. And also that on January the 23rd, we will have at your gallery, wine and fish tasting. And if anybody is interested, just go to the Kosher Wine Society's website or go to my blog where there is a link directly to the Kosher Wine Society and reserve your spot, because it's a small gallery, only 40 people will be allowed in. So in the meantime, I want to thank you for being a superb guest,
for providing us
with a fascinating hour of conversation.
Thank you.
You allowed us to know not just a little bit about art history, but more specifically about who is Yigal Fedida. And for that, we thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for giving it.
My pleasure. Thank you all, ladies and gentlemen. We will be here with you again next Wednesday evening at 10 o'clock. Eastern time, the same spot, blacktalkradio.com/kosherscene. Thank you and good night, one and all.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you.